I would not say we're going to go from the sublime to the ridiculous now, but I would say we're going to go from the sublime to the pedantic. I think it's probably what's going to happen because... What?
I didn't hear that. Would you... Did everybody hear?
Do.
Not everybody heard that.
Well,
we love your manner of
pedantry. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to pick up on a theme that Marianne just touched on at the start of her presentation. That was alluded to in the quote by Augustine about who do I love when I say I love God, and the further remark about how we pray will depend a lot on how we understand God and how we perceive God. That's the thing that I want to focus on in my part of this. And of course, there's a whole bunch of ways that people perceive and understand God and the way God works. So to keep it simple, what I'm going to do is confine things to just the two concepts that we have been investigating over the last couple of months, the notion of strong and the notion of weak concepts of God, realizing there's a whole bunch more, many more possibilities than just those two. Two things, as I have pondered it, and indeed as I've experienced it over 36 years of pastoral ministry, two things really characterize the prayer of those who see God as strong. And by strong, again, I mean the omnipotent, the omniscient, but also the loving and caring God. If you don't think God loves and cares, then you know, all bets really are off. And there are indeed people who believe in God and also believe God doesn't care. But I'm talking about the people who believe, truly believe, God is omniscient, God is omnipotent, and God deeply loves and cares for all of creation, and particularly for us. First, of course, is the belief that God can do anything. God can protect the weak, chastise the strong, heal the sick, even the mortally ill. God can do that. And generally, God can, from time to time, suspend the laws of physics, biology, chemistry, in order to produce an outcome that would otherwise be impossible. And those are what we call miracles in the modern sense of the term. But the second characteristic is the equally strong belief that God knows everything. And therefore, because we know almost nothing compared to God, there are times when no matter how much we desire something, no matter how much we feel and believe that we want, and not only want, but need it, there are times when we have to defer to the greater wisdom of God. There are just times when we have to do that. When the plane crashes, despite our pleas for safe travel, when the beloved dies, despite our prayers for recovery from illness, when your son or daughter does not come home from the war, despite the daily prayers to God to keep our children safe, this is not because prayer failed. This is because God did what was best, no matter how painful it may be for those who suffer that loss, whatever it may be. Those are the two things that characterize prayer in the sense of prayer to the strong God. A phrase from the prayer of St. Chrysostom, as a matter of fact, which ends morning and evening prayer in the Anglican tradition, I think summarizes this perspective beautifully. Chrysostom wrote, "Fulfill now, O Lord, our desires and petitions as may be best for us, granting us in this world knowledge of thy truth, in the age to come life everlasting. Fulfill now, O Lord, our desires and petitions as may be best for us," always deferring to the greater wisdom of God. Truly faithful people who deeply believe in what we're calling strong theology do not presume to know what is best for them. They know what they want. They know what they believe they need. But they also know that God is going to arrange for the outcome that is best for everyone, is best for the faithful, no matter how mystifying, no matter how painful, no matter how tragic, no matter how simply unsatisfying it might seem. God is going to bring about the best outcome. So, along with rejoicing in the happy ending, along with rejoicing in the desired outcome, there is also the acceptance of the sad outcome, and to trust that in the end, and by the end I mean after our own death, when we see what God sees and know what God knows, whatever we will also realize that whatever happened, that was for the best for everyone concerned. Those to me are the two characteristics: the belief in God, that God can do anything, and the belief that God will do what is best. Those are the two things I believe that characterize most consistently the prayer of people who pray to the God of strong theology. Now, some folks call this blind faith. And they either call it blind faith as a compliment or as a term of derision, even, at times. And I suppose that's one way to describe it. But what I want us all to notice, those of us who completely reject this notion of God, and therefore this concept of prayer, as well as those of us who accept it, what I want us to notice is that this idea requires an immense trust in that which we cannot possibly begin to understand. In fact, people who claim, I know what God wants, and I'm praying in accord with God's will, they are not really praying to the God of strong theology. They are praying to an idol. They don't know they're praying to an idol. They do not know that, but that, in fact, is what's going on. To those who are really praying to the God of strong theology, what they are doing is undergoing a complete submission of the ego to a power that is utterly and entirely beyond us. That is what they're doing. And even though I myself do not subscribe at this point in my life to this notion of prayer, I find that attitude, that posture, to be not only admirable, but I believe it is a worthy goal for all of us to pursue. That submission of the ego to that which is so much bigger than us that we cannot even understand it, and certainly cannot fathom or control it. To reach the moment, in other words, when we realize that we do not control our own destiny, that we are utterly dependent upon a universe over which we exercise no meaningful control whatsoever, and therefore begin to look at ourselves with a certain humility, and at creation, the whole universe, with a certain awe. Well, from my point of view, even though I do not believe in this notion of prayer, that is spiritual progress, as far as I'm concerned, regardless of your theological perspective. Strong or weak theology aside, that to me is spiritual progress. So if you have, though, this strong notion of God, then it seems to me that it would be very odd not to pray in just this way, though. Not to pray for healing, not to pray for the new job, not to pray for safety for people who travel, not to pray for the outcome that you want, the outcome that you believe you need. I think that would be remarkably odd to say, no, I won't do that. I'm not going to do that. No, I'm beyond that. That would be so odd if you have a faith in a strong theology. Indeed, it seems to me that there's ample evidence in Scripture that God is annoyed by that attitude. It irritates God that people will not. That famous scene in the 7th chapter of Isaiah came to my mind immediately as I was thinking about this. You know, the scene about the young woman, the prophecy of Isaiah about the young woman conceiving and bearing a child whose name will be called Emmanuel. That's preceded by Ahaz self-righteously saying to God, when God says, ask for a sign, it can be as high as heaven or as low as Sheol, ask for a sign, I will give it to you. And Ahaz says, oh, no, far be it from me to test, I will not put my Lord to the test. And God says, it's not a test, you idiot. It is not a test. It is a sign that I'm offering you. And if you won't pray for it, that really annoys me. And he says, therefore, that's what I'm going to do. And then comes this famous thing. Is it too little for you to weary men that you must also weary my God? And then comes this wonderfully misquoted a prophecy of the sign, which Matthew turns into a prediction of the birth of Jesus to Mary while she's still a virgin. But that's God saying, I don't like it. I don't like it when you refuse to pray to me. That just is really so annoying that you self-righteously imagine that you're beyond this. Well, you're not. This false piety which says, I won't bother you, God. God says, I want to be bothered. There's also the story which reinforces this very point of God wanting to be bothered. In Luke, where this cranky, unsympathetic judge, the parable of the unjust judge, he finally caves in. And he says, almost literally, oh, to hell with it. When this lady, this widow, you know, a powerless person in society, this widow with nothing to give to the judge to get him to sway in her favor, finally he says, okay, I give up. You won't go away. I will give you a fair hearing. And then he vindicates her because actually her cause is just. So the unjust judge finally caves in and says, okay. And the point of this parable, says Luke, is that we should pray always and not lose heart. Okay? So if your theology of God is strong, then there's a lot in the Bible that says you need to pray that way. You know, don't be a doofus. Pray that way. Finally, of course, there's the statement in the Sermon on the Mount, which is quoted all the time in various contexts, some of which are good and some of which are not. This one is accurate. Ask and it will be given you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. Everyone who seeks finds. Everyone who knocks will find the door is opened. That's the statement that Matthew gives to Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. This way of praying, I think for that reason, and for others, of course, as well, it remains by far the most popular. It's comforting in a very deep way to believe that we are truly and fully cared for, that no matter what happens, we can trust the will of the one who loves us more even than we love ourselves, and that our prayers are always heard, no matter what happens. That's the prayer of the person who believes in a strong theological perception of God. And again, I'm bracketing the kind of perverse uses of this kind of prayer. I'm bracketing them and saying this kind of prayer can be abused in 100 different ways. I'm bracketing those and saying for the people who really, really deeply understand a strong theology and who pray in that vein, this is a remarkable way to live. It truly is. But we also know as well that this way of praying comes with a very high cost. I remember, and I will remember as long as I live, a fellow at a retreat telling us the story of the death of his 3-year-old daughter. Explaining to us, and I was so young, I was simply outraged. I was way too young to be in the presence of this sort of thing, and I reacted completely inappropriately, let me say. In fact, I ran away from the retreat. I went down to a bar and got a beer. By the time I'd finished the beer, I thought, okay, I can go back and finish this thing. But anyway, that's about me. Anyway, what he told us was that this 3-year-old daughter of his had never belonged to either to him or his wife. This 3-year-old girl had always belonged to God. And therefore, when God reclaimed her for his own reasons, and I do say his, when God reclaimed her for his own reasons, there could be no argument. There could be no response other than to say, thanks for the 3 years. That's all there could be. He had, in other words, arranged to believe that the death of his child was part of God's plan, not just for her, but for him and his wife. And that makes that kind of prayer extremely costly. Because what you have to decide when you pray that way, what you have to decide when you decide God knows more than I do, is in order to sustain that kind of belief, you have to believe this sort of thing. And it makes grief really complicated. And this, to me, is part of an answer to Norwin's comment. It's one thing that makes grief so complicated for this kind of theological perspective. And it's one thing, as a matter of fact, that makes often causes us to move into denial. I can't feel grief. I'm not supposed to feel grief. I'm just supposed to be thankful for God's plan and for God's providence. And it really makes grief complicated. And it makes pain quite often the winner. So I remember also as well a family and their friends who prayed for the recovery from cancer for a beloved family member, believing right up to the moment that this person died that God would deliver a miracle. And that the reason for this cancer is so that the recovery of this person from cancer would be a testimony of the power of God for everyone they knew to see. He's gonna recover, and that's going to be a testimony that will change this whole region where they lived. And he died. And the bitterness and the resentment that infected the widow, as far as I could see, stayed with her forever. Because once again, she had to pay this cost of maintaining a perspective that somehow God did what was right, despite the fact that we had everything kind of sussed out. That's really painful. Now, none of this, or 10,000 experiences like it, refute the notion, by the way, of an omniscient and omnipotent God who has a plan for everybody and who knows what's best for all, regardless of what happens. None of this refutes that. Such a view, and the reason it doesn't refute it, is because this view is what we would call an untestable hypothesis. And as such, it is irrefutable. It can't be proved. It cannot be disproven. And that's what makes it so satisfying and so wonderfully reinforcing, and at the same time, so very, very costly. When what we want happens, it is the answer to prayer and the proof that God is watching out for us. And most of us with any experience in the institutional church will have heard testimonies to the greatness of God founded upon this very thing, founded upon stories of prayer that was answered in the way we wanted them answered. But when our deepest hopes are dashed, when our lives are destroyed simply by what happens, the challenge of faith becomes different. The challenge of faith becomes one of hanging on to that notion of an omnipotent and omniscient being who loves and cares for us despite the destruction of what we knew we had to have in order to keep life worth living. That's a very high cost. And I'm not saying it is not a cost that people are not willing to pay. It's a cost that lots of people are willing to pay, sometimes without even knowing it. But that's the world you live in when you pray to the God of strong theology. And some people do it better than others. Some people do it more profoundly and deeply than others. And I believe it's also partly for this reason that some people I know who started out with this view of God and therefore this notion of prayer have not only abandoned prayer, but faith in God altogether. I know many people like this. I don't even know how many people I know like this, but lots. It's altogether possible, indeed, I would say, it's altogether likely that some of you here today have a story like that. Like the two that I told. That some of you here today have decided, I don't understand prayer, I can't pray anymore, because I can't believe in a God who hears, who notices, who cares. I can't believe in that anymore, and so therefore I can't do it. Others have abandoned this view for what I consider to be a more kind of academic or pedantic reason. That kind of understanding of God simply no longer makes sense in a world dominated by science and by the scientific worldview. You know, how can I pray to a God in the 21st century in this way? How can I do that? And for many people, the answer is, I can't. I just can't do it. I can't understand God in those strong terms. Some folks, of course, never had such a view in the first place, either because they were not raised in the church, or because they were, and it always seemed kind of silly, or something, I don't know. But some people never had such a view, and therefore never had anything to give up. So what I want to do at this point is simply to conclude with a few thoughts about what prayer could look like for all the people in that group, all the people who live there. And I'm going to use this model of weak theology that we've been discussing. Because weak theology, now Marianne talked a bit about weak theology as well, and I'll just simply add another nuance or two. Weak theology offers an understanding of God that rejects the notion of a supreme being. It just does. And instead offers a model of God as complete openness to the universe. God is the invitation to see the interconnectedness of all life and to shape one's life on the acceptance of that invitation. God is, or maybe we should say God is in, the plea for true justice for all. God is in the quest to establish it. God, or again, maybe what I want to say is the effect of God, is mercy, compassion, forgiveness, love, especially love for the unlovable, especially mercy for the merciless. In such a view of God, the whole notion of prayer as some sort of conversation with a supreme being in which we make, again to quote Chrysostom, our desires and petitions known to an omniscient and omnipotent being, that makes no sense in the weak theological perspective. Even though I know a number of people who have in some regard abandoned this supreme being notion long ago, who still pray this way. And I think they still pray this way in part because, as Marianne rightly pointed out, prayer, in one way or another, is an essential component of the human experience. It just is. We are, I believe, hardwired for it. So within this context of this view of God, it seems to me that for those who embrace this notion, prayer is more of an attitude. Prayer is more of a way of being in the world than it is any sort of verbal statement, either aloud or silently, to something. Prayer is the eternal struggle to become ever more open, ever more connected to everyone and indeed to everything. Prayer is the quest to identify where in every moment we might uncover the opportunity for greater honesty, more complete mercy, fuller compassion, and to locate the place where love is to be found in any moment, no matter how obscure it is to us. Where was love to be found when Marcus died? Marianne discovered it, and it changed everything, as she has testified, and I will not amplify on further. Prayer, in other words, is what happens when people find themselves, either consciously or not, seeking the divine where no one else is looking, indeed, seeking the divine where God can't possibly be. In this moment of such extreme grief, where is love? Where is God here? That's prayer, from my point of view. And it might be a prayer of rage or something else, but that's prayer, a deep and abiding prayer. And this is why I say the statement that we got at the end of, or during the reflection time, so beautifully summarizes this. For those who find themselves in a kind of weak theological perspective, prayer is ceaseless. To the extent that we are engaged in the process of our own becoming, of our own development as human beings, as people in relationship to others, everything we do is a prayer. It may be a terrible prayer. know, God, make me better at chess than this person. You wouldn't say it that way. So it may be a bad prayer, but it may be a good prayer as well. But prayer in this context is something that is going on 100% of the time. And these moments, too, by the way, are documented in Scripture. They're not nearly as numerous. They're not as clear as the strong moments. But there are a few that I'm reflecting upon. I didn't do any research. I just thought, where can I come up with something? You know. But Elijah, he flees. You know, he wipes out all the prisoners, all the priests of Baal, which really irritates the folks in charge. So he flees, understandably, you know, they're a source of income. Anyway, he flees and he hides in this cave. And here's a mighty wind. God is not in the mighty wind. He feels the earthquake. God is not in the earthquake. He sees this huge fire. God is not in the fire. God is not in any of this. Then he hears what the King James Version translates as the still small voice, and which Paul Simon, I think, translates much more beautifully as the sound of silence. And he realizes that's God. And he goes to the mouth of the cave and encounters the divine right there and then. Paul, St. Paul, those of you who have heard me before know that Paul, despite all the accusations about his misogyny and so forth, which I think are unfounded, I mean, he was an honorary person who was very argumentative and I think mean-spirited at times, but he was not a misogynist. Anyway, Paul abandons his prayer to the strong God, that this strong God will remove the thorn in his flesh, whatever that is. Because the only response he has ever gotten from God when he prays three times that God remove this thorn in my flesh, the only response he gets from God is, no. My grace is good enough for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. So God gives up on that prayer. And from that point on, he tells us his ironical, sardonic boast is of his weakness. It's the only thing I'm going to do. It's the only thing I'm going to boast about is how weak I am. The tradition Christianity has transmitted, and this to me is the most remarkable thing, the tradition Christianity has transmitted for 2,000 years is that the power and the presence of God is revealed to the whole world in a crucified man. Think about that for a moment. Now, that's obscured by the fact that we, Christians, the institutional church, subsequently dressed him in imperial robes. We placed him at the head of marching armies. We imagine that he ordered the death of millions. But what I want us to see is, from the point of view of the moment, that's all nonsense. That's how we got it wrong. Crucifixion, then and now, is weakness personified, weakness incarnated. He died. He was killed. He was murdered. He was executed on trumped-up charges. He did not deserve to die, and he did. That is as weak as you can be. And that, we say, is the presence of God in this world. No amount, no number of human attempts to deny this plain fact can change the truth of that, even though for 1,700 years we've been doing the best we can to hide from it. And for the most part, fairly successfully. You know, for the most part, we have. But to pray within the context of what we are calling weak theology, to pray to the one who was crucified, as far as I'm concerned, is to reject the robes. It is to reject the armies. It is to reject the violence, not because we don't believe in the presence of the divine right here and now, but precisely because we do believe in that presence, manifested in a particular way, in the obscure, the unknown, the places where God can't be, the invitation to openness, the plea for justice. And from my point of view, that is prayer. When we seek to be open enough, perhaps even just barely open enough to perceive this, that quest, that hope, that struggle, that to me is prayer. So again, thank you very much for listening.
Okay, let's just sit in the silence for a minute and just continue to let what we've heard kind of work in us. And at the end of a minute, I'll ring the bell, and then we will invite you to engage in what you've heard and what you're thinking.
I have two questions that have come up for me in this leaving of the strong theology and moving into a weak theology. My son, is when he was like 19, said to me, "We know that if one person kills another person, that who's guilty. But what about someone who has the power to stop that and witnesses it and doesn't interrupt? Don't we also have a sense that that person is guilty because they did not act?" So in leaving the strong theology, he was pointing out to me that if God is present everywhere, because I've always told him God doesn't know the future, I rejected that the first thing on the list, that God is sitting on the edge of God's seat wondering what we're going to do. You know, what are they going to do now? But my son was calling, but if God is present in all things at the moment and has the power to interfere, isn't God guilty? Okay, that's the first question. And then the second question has to do with the responsibility of humans in response to God's will. And so therefore, since you pointed out that Jesus was murdered on trumped up charges, crucified, tortured by humans, that it was against God's will for Jesus to be crucified.
Well, this is taking us away from the notion of prayer, as far as I'm concerned, but very briefly I would say, if you're in a strong theological posture, you would say the murder that was witnessed by someone who could have stopped it is part of God's plan. And in a way, then everybody's off the hook. But so I don't think, I'm not sure, if, from a weak theological posture, you're looking at it from an entirely different perspective. You're looking at it from the tragedy of human existence, the dilemma of our own self-interest. You're looking at it from a place of deep and genuine sadness and asking yourself, where do we go from here? Where is God in this? Not presuming to know. From the point of view of Jesus, again, a strong theological posture, that's quite clear. Jesus is a sacrifice made on behalf of the whole world. By the time you get to the letter of Hebrews, it is very difficult to tell even how Jesus died. It's really hard. It's mentioned, I think, once or twice in the letter to the Hebrews. The death of Jesus is simply a deal between God and Jesus to save the world. So, yes, it's absolutely God's plan from the strong theological perspective. From the weak theological perspective, I think you're moving into completely different territory, I've run into, which is that, isn't it amazing to me, isn't it amazing to all of us, that the story of the death of this person was not told from the point of view of the people who got rid of him? It was told from the point of view of the victim. And so this is not this. Imagine the crucifixion story told from the point of view of Pilate. We have yet another loudmouth rabble rouser, and I did my job, and I did it well, and now our community is safe again. Period. That's the crucifixion of Jesus told from the point of view of Pilate. But the crucifixion of Jesus told from the point of view of Jesus is told very differently. We know that he was innocent. And that tells us a lot. God is present in the death of the innocent. And that's going to change you. If you decide that your scapegoats are in fact innocent, then you're going to stop scapegoating people. I don't see how you can continue to do it. So anyway, that's just a brief thought. Well, we need to go on to somebody else. We can talk about this later, but let's go on to Judy.
Now I've lost what I was going to say because I was listening. The concept of prayer, this has been so helpful. Thank you so much. I love both. I love the way you talk about strong theology, weak theology. It's not something I was familiar with before I came to these talks. And I was very much, I am a very much, you know, constant prayer person. I never stop. I have a conversation going in my head all the time with my concept of Jesus and God and the Holy Spirit. And it's always been that way for me. And so I was a proponent of strong theology as a child and early on in my Christianity. Definitely felt that God was listening all the time. But it's an interesting thing. I never thought that meant that things would go my way.
Right.
I was always amazed by the surprises in my life. Yeah. And I ran into my prayer journal just the other day from 25 years ago. And I'm really glad I kept it. I got rid of most of the writing I did during that time because I didn't want anyone to find it. Yeah. It was such a leveling time in my life. And I was so terrified. And reading that bits of the prayer journal that I just read, you know, reminds me of how even then when I was in, makes me cry a little bit, when I was in this really desperate place, I was just writing down what I hoped for and ways I needed help. And I had learned already when I was writing this that I couldn't make deals with God because I had tried and I had said, okay, I'll give up that, but I won't give up this. And it'll be okay if that goes, but not this.
Yeah.
And all the ones that were my bottom lines except the safety of my children all went. And sometimes it felt like the safety of my children was going as well. And I didn't lose any hope. So that confirmed for me that I was, you know, my prayer was okay for me, whether it was to a strong, but it definitely transpired from the strength to the weak theology, definitely during the time of my accepting surprises.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I don't want to embarrass you.
Thank you.
But you are an example of the person I was talking about when I said, you know, you can bracket all kinds of perverse uses of this strong theology. You're exactly the kind of person, Judy, that I was talking about, without you in mind as I wrote it, but you're the kind of person I was talking about when I talked about the faithful use of strong theology. The person who actually will submit her ego to this God that she can't quite understand and certainly can't control. And at the same time say, and this is what I really need. And so you are the sort of person that I was talking about when I was talking about a faithful use of the strong theological concept. And I will emphasize again that I find that to be admirable.
I do too.
Regardless of how one looks at God, that submission, that willingness to accept and trust what actually happens is an admirable place to be in this world and towards this world. So, I mean, thank you for talking about that.
There's also something about strong theology and the fierceness with which we, and the impassioned, you know, sense of will and hope that we have that is often connected with strong theology, that just to support and follow what you're saying, there's something about that that's really admirable. Yeah. And to kind of seize that kind of passion mm-hmm. and fierceness, I think, is important.
So, Bill, this is addressed to you, but also Marianne, if you would chime in. No question here, but I'd like to get your responses on two things. Number one, talking about quantity versus quality of prayer, meaning continuing the conversation in constant communication with God all day long. It just intuitively feels good, perhaps. But what about the person who says, I'm not going to bother that. I'm just going to pray when it really, really is important, and I need God to answer that. So that's kind of. The other one is prayers for others versus self. And I believe praying for other people is a lot easier because you say, you know, Lord, please correct the situation, whatever right. it might be. And that seems to be easy. You can get along with that. But praying for self means, oh, here comes the vulnerabilities. I'm going to have to maybe change or, you know, express my vulnerabilities so that, God, can you please change me? Can you give us a little help on this?
Maybe, probably not, but but that won't stop me from trying. Either of those perspectives, in terms of constant prayer, quality versus quantity, I think could fit into either kind of theological perspective. The notion again is what you're praying for and what your perspective on it is. To say that I'm only going to pray for what I really need really speaks to a strong theological perspective. And as I say, I think in the weak theological perspective, prayer again is more of an attitude. It's more of a way of being in the world. In which you are ceaselessly questing for. You don't really say, today I'm going to work for justice and tomorrow I'm not. I mean, you could.
Some of us do.
Some of us do. But from a weak theological perspective, that quest needs to be ceaseless. Even though I can't go to Washington and pass the Equal Rights Amendment and then get it back to the states, I don't have the clout to do that. I can work for the complete and full enfranchisement and rights of women in this society all the time. Which I do think is a good idea. And what I'm suggesting is, from the perspective of weak theology, that is prayer at work. As opposed to just discreetly saying, God, will you please tell Mitch McConnell to get off the stick and do something, you know, that would be more of a prayer from a strong theological perspective. But so I don't know if that's helpful, but I don't see any problem at all for people with a genuinely strong theological perspective to pester God ceaselessly. As I say, I think there's ample biblical precedent that is how God wants it. If that's your theological perspective, if that's your understanding of God, then I think you're foolish not to do that. And you are annoying God by refusing to do it. Pester God, the unjust judge, the Isaiah passage, and several others, by the way, that I could have mentioned. So I don't think that the quality versus quantity thing, especially from a strong theological perspective, it's all in favor of quantity, I think. I really do.
Yeah. I don't know what more you have to say.
Well, the only thing that comes to my mind about this is the punitive superego.
Yes.
And I suggest that it's one's punitive superego saying, well, gosh, is it quantity or quality? It really should be quality because the... Da, 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 da. Yeah. Or, you know, it's so much easier to pray for them than it is for me because I'm, you know, yeah. I don't know. Then that might... I think that's the voice of the punitive superego. And that may or may not be a helpful reference when it comes to prayer.
Yeah. I agree with you, by the way. It is much easier to pray for other people than it is for us. Mostly it is. A few of us who tend to be sociopathic, probably, just pray for ourselves all the time and don't think about much else. But again, I think that has more to do with mental health than anything else. I'm not sure about that. I don't want to make anybody mad at me necessarily, but So yeah, but I do think, I do like your idea, Marianne, that that has, a well-balanced prayer life would include both. A well-balanced prayer life would be definitely able to value myself as much as I value other people, but not more. And therefore would feel as free to pray for my own needs as for those of others. Again, because that punitive superego is now in check. And that false humility that arises as a result of the blandishments of the punitive superego has been defeated, if you will, has been overcome.
I think that's a really good point.
I also wonder if when we pray for other people, we kind of sort of hope that it'll turn out in our image. So, but I'm all for praying for other people. I mean, I'm big on compassion and empathy and all of that. But I think these are just little things we need to check on every so often. It's like, so what am I really hoping that they're going to, how are they going to change?
Right. You know, exactly.
That kind of thing. Really. But again, I'm all for prayer. Pray without, I think it's important. I think it's vital. And maybe we'll say a little bit more next time about the notions of summons and call and hope.
Right.
Because I think, and you started to address that so powerfully at the end of your talk, but we'll pick up with that because I think that's very much related to prayer.
And the only thing I'll add is, those are important questions, by the way. Mm. The intercessory notion and the quality versus quantity. Yeah. I've encountered that a lot. And I think they are very important questions. And the fact that I can't give a particularly good answer says something about me rather than something about those questions. Those are important considerations.
We have time for maybe another comment or two.
I probably missed this, but I would appreciate you,
there you are,
naming it again. What is the high cost of praying from the weak perspective?
You did not miss it. I actually had it in the initial draft and thought, man, this is just too long. And so one of the things I cut out was that.
And here's your opportunity to bring it back.
Here's my opportunity,
in.
Yeah. I, from my point of view, the cost of the weak theology is that profound feeling of helplessness that can occur. If you're praying from a weak theology, the fact that the futility of this quest for justice, the futility of mercy for the merciless, the futility of compassion for those who won't exercise compassion themselves, that just feels horrible a lot of the time. And what are we to do when our quest is completely defeated, when our efforts at justice, when our openness to the world is so clearly rejected by so much of the world? I think that's a very high cost of prayer from the weak theological perspective. And it is why I had that Reinhold Niebuhr quote in my head as I came in here. And I wish I had indeed somehow worked it into the text, but it didn't occur to me, that these things cannot be accomplished in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. They cannot. And so the issue is, do you give up and just abandon all faith whatsoever in the possibility of justice, or are you saved by hope?
Right.
And those who are deeply immersed in a weak theology are saved by hope, because they often have no specific outcome to point to. Yeah. So, but anyway, thanks for that question. Because I wanted to talk about that and just thought, this is starting to get boring even to me. And so I left it out, but thank you for that.
Yeah, I love your response. I love what you say about Niebuhr and hope. Yeah. And I think that the challenge of weak theology is that sense that this is futile. Is that sense that, oh my gosh, this isn't, I don't see any immediate response to this, or justice will never happen, okay? The power of weak theology is the hope that yes, it will. To never give up on that, and to not be distracted by the fact that this isn't, doesn't seem to be happening now. Yeah. But for heaven's sakes, to coin a phrase, don't abandon the hope that justice is yet and will come. Justice is in our midst, and it will come.
Yeah.
So I think that's the tension within Weak Theology. And in some ways, it's an interesting kind of other side of the coin of Strong Theology. Strong Theology is saying it's going to happen now. And then if it doesn't, then...
it's because God has some larger plan that we'll bring it about and so forth.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah.
And Weak Theology, I think, in a sense, takes more responsibility for what might come.
Oh, yeah.
How many more? I know of at least three hands that I've seen urgently come up here.
It's 11:45, so maybe we have...
one more?
Yeah, we have five more minutes, so let's see what we can do. Go ahead.
Let's see what we can do.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to start here back there, and if we have time, Becca, we're here again.
Okay. Don't you think that's why it's said so many times, do not fear, that fear is the lack of hope?
Yeah. Well, and that indeed in the Johannine correspondence, perfect love casts out fear. And I think that's a big, big hunk of it, is that, and indeed, to quote Hebrews again, faith is the evidence of things not seen. And again, to get back to the unjust judge, pray always, do not lose heart.
Yeah, do not lose heart.
Keep on, as Dylan said, and Tangled Up in Blue, keep on keeping on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing about, that I want to say about, it will yet come. Please don't mistake that for the afterlife. Like, everything is going to be all right in the afterlife. I mean, we don't know. But the imperative for us as human beings is this life.
What are we doing with this world?
What are we going to do in this life?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a question about trust. Trust keeps coming up in my head trying to sort of transition and wrap my head around strong theology versus weak theology. And in strong theology, in a history of a lot of us with the church, at least there was something a little bit more tangible to say you put your trust in. And as I'm trying to wrap my head around, the weak theology, which is, I think, where my head has been for decades, but not really known how to describe it, I find I'm not sure that there's anything tangible or describable to say I'm putting my trust in. And I just wondered if you would speak to that about how would you describe what you are putting your trust in if you are particularly praying as a weak theologian?
Yeah. I have pondered that myself at some length and come up with only one answer. Trust that this is the right path. Trust that I'm moving in the direction that whoever and whatever God is in this moment, that I am following the path that is laid out for me there. That's where I see trust. In the absence of this giant, omnipotent, omniscient being, it's trust that this moment, that what I should look for in this moment is love, compassion, and mercy, rather than how to control, either through violence or some coercive power. Trust that that is the right path. Now, say the right path means I am, again, imposing something on the universe, if you will, and saying there is, just in terms of the being of the universe itself, a right path. And that's a big, big assumption that I have to, that I personally do believe in. Yeah. Then, yeah, let's hear from you.
So I find this so refreshing, to bring all this out. I mean, they're kind of things that just don't get talked about. But if we had these kinds of conversations, do you think we would see less of people pulling away from church? I mean, there's so so many fewer people now who really are here and are part of us.
Yeah.
Pat, what do you think?
I didn't hear you.
What do you think?
Well, for myself, I just find it so refreshing, but don't I think that more people, if this were really talked about, would draw people more to wanting compassion and wanting these things that we're talking about when we consider prayer, whichever way you look at it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it just be more inviting to people if we had these conversations? Not that I know where that would be done if they weren't interested, but...
Well, I would say that the conversation that we're having is truly at the heart of the Christian tradition, not exclusively, okay? But I think it's at the heart of the tradition. So for us to unpack this a little bit, I think is a way for us to be more curious about the tradition itself and our experience of it, and it helps to... I mean, and to call the question on some assumptions, I think that's really healthy. And tradition, if it's, it has to stay alive, which means it changes. So, I mean, I love what you're suggesting. Might more people be curious about what's going on in church or what are these people thinking or whatever, to open up these conversations? Yes. I would hope that people would want to come and taste and see, as it were, or take another look. Because I think there's a lot here to love, and that there is a lot of love in what we're talking about and what you were saying about compassion and justice. And that's the heart and soul of the Judeo-Christian tradition, in my opinion.
Yeah, and my response to your question is, in the long run, yes. In fact, I think in the long run it will happen. In the short run, no. Because there is so much inertia that has been generated over 2,000 years by the notion that the Bible is history, and that therefore we need to conform everything we do to, we need to arrange to believe that all of this stuff actually happened. There's so much inertia generated by the structures of the institution itself, which will be inherently self-protective. I mean, I have not heard anyone come out and say, you know, I think we've done this wrong, so we should dissolve the United States of America and start over. I actually have not heard that proposed. And in the same way, I have not heard it proposed, you know, we've just gotten this kind of wrong, we need to dissolve Christianity and start over. Because Christianity is important and we need it, and so we need to do it differently. So we're going to adjourn this meeting and then reconvene in 100 years and do it again. I just haven't heard that proposal. So it's going to happen very, very slowly. It's going to happen over a long period of time, but I think it has to happen, not because we plan it, but because it is inevitable. It's getting harder and harder and harder to sustain the notion of Christianity as we have traditionally experienced it, and easier and easier and easier for people to sustain the notion of Christianity as we are discussing it here. We are not the only people who are doing this. The question is not what's going on inside the church, in other words. The question is going on is what is going on outside the church. And over time, I think that conversation will get wider and wider and wider. But it's going to take a long time. To give you one quick example, if in the year 33, or let's say 73, a little after Mark's gospel, maybe about the time Mark's gospel, someone had said, how do you think the church will look in 1,000 years? No one would have said there will be a pope in Rome who has the largest army in Europe.
That's right.
We will be invading in the name of God the Holy Land. No one would have said that. We will be the richest, most powerful organization in Europe. In fact, the only thing holding European culture together, actually, will be this organization that does everything it does through coercion. Nobody in the first century would have come up with this scenario, and the person who had would have been said, you can't get there from here. Well, it turns out you can. I say the same thing about the church 1,000 years from now. Whatever happens 1,000 years from now, from the point of view of today, we will say, you can't get there from here. And yet, we're going to.
Great.
Okay. We need to be done.
We do. Our next gathering will be the second Saturday of February, second Saturday, which is February 8th. So come join us, bring a friend from 9:30 until noon, and we'll talk about call and summons and hope. And let me close this session with the poem by Yehuda Amichai, From the Place Where We Are Right. From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are right is hard and trampled like a yard. But doubts and loves dig up the world like a mole, a plow. And a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood.